ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National. A show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
When you pick up a gaming controller, are you playing something handcrafted by humans, fueled by caffeine and deadlines? Or are you wandering through a world stitched together by artificial intelligence that never sleeps? AI is sliding into game development pipelines, but the rules around telling players what is machine-made and what is made by people are patchy at best. So how much transparency do players deserve? And does it even matter? My name is Ray Johnston, and you are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now and why they matter, we have joining me Chloe Appleby, Games Curator at the Powerhouse Museum. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
And Alex Kidman, who is a freelance technology journalist at Alex Reviews Tech. Alex, welcome back.
Also nice to be back.
Now, we know that AI tools are being used throughout game development, generating concept art, testing code, even drafting some slightly dodgy, I'd say, dialogue at times. But Chloe, could you talk us through what kinds of AI tools studios are actually using right now? How embedded are they in the average development pipeline? Is it really commonplace?
Yeah, I mean, pre-generative AI, there was the non-generative AI. Developers use that for like NPCs, different types of dialogue, different gameplay. So
NPCs being non-playable characters. When you're playing a video game and you approach someone in the game and they don't really do anything, but
yes,
they might give you a quest, for instance.
Correct.
And non-playable character
and you
NPC.
Are the
Got
playable
it.
Character. So that's always been around, but I think the main sticking point has been the generative AI, where it's this system making and spitting and churning stuff out that has really outraged quite a lot of players and a lot of developers too. It is being used in a lot of games. We've seen in Steam, 7% of games on Steam currently are made with some sort of AI component to them that's been declared. One of the benefits of it is for programmers, so any mundane or repetitive tasks, they're able to cipher, say, 50,000 lines of code and find an error using AI rather than taking hours and hours and trying to find potentially it's a dot in the middle of this whole line of code text. So there is some benefits to it. However, there can also be creative demerits.
I can understand the outrage when it comes to things like creating imagery and concept art and the more artistic human expression side of things. That's the vitriol that we see against a lot of generative AI in all sorts of spaces. When it comes to things like coding, though, I feel like that's something that's become a lot more accepted as time goes on, that AI and generative AI specifically is going to be something that helps us code lots of different things. Is that what you're seeing, Alex, in games?
Yeah, look, definitely. Although I feel like the division feels a little artificial to me. And the reason I say that is because good code is art. Good coding is artistic. It's a
yes.
creative endeavor. And I think the more of that we offload to AI, the more we say, you must use these AI tools, the more danger we hit. Yes, you can perhaps find your one dot in 50,000 lines of code, but if you don't understand what the other 49,999 lines are doing, then there's a big, big problem here. That being said, a lot of the major studios are absolutely mandating if you're working as a programmer, you have to use their suite of AI tools along with the, as Chloe was pointing out, the generative AI stuff around music and art and visuals and dialogue.
Are we at a point where AI is starting to shape core creative decisions? Do we have that 7% of games that are sitting on Steam, the most common platform to play your PC games on right now?
are they being created from scratch using generative AI? Like, I'm thinking about the romance novels that are being pumped out by artificial intelligence at the moment. Is that what we're seeing in games?
Yeah, and I mean, especially like the cozy game genre. There's just that.
My favourite.
Same. And it's just all that. A slop is a terminology that we use where there's these makers just churning stuff out using generative AI just to make a quick buck. But there's also other games where they're using voice acting through AI to manipulate different types of dialogue that's already been presented by actors or just creating it from scratch. Same thing with different images. It is influencing some creative decisions in games, but
I think it's hard not to see it as ultimately influencing, even for those games where they say, oh, look, we used AI to create placeholder art. Because even if you did then get a real, actual, physical human being to come and do the final sketches and smooth things out and make sure that all the characters only had five fingers and stuff like this, you're still basing it off that AI, quote-unquote, original. So there's an influence there. Because, and there's so many excellent kind of retrospectives on how different games were developed. There are even games which have their own museums within them that do this kind of thing. You look at all this concept art and you look at how it tracks through to the, you know, final pixelated or polygon form. Well, if you start with something that was AI generated in the first place, of course that has an impact on your final product.
Absolutely.
What are the disclosure rules around AI usage in video games? Do developers have to let us as players know that we're playing a game that was made by generative AI instead of by people?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
So it depends on the platform. If you're talking the major console platforms, not really at all. Steam has guidelines for it, but they've revised those, and it's basically, at the time of recording, because all these things are subject to change, a text field that the developers can just put whatever they like in there, really.
Yeah.
They can own up to everything, or they can say, you know, we used AI once, but we didn't inhale.
And presumably they could lie in that as well. They could say made by humans, but no one's checking.
Well, Steam is taking it on faith, essentially,
yeah.
Yes. And there doesn't seem, no one, outside of public backlash, which we might be getting to in a minute, I suspect, there's no evidence. There doesn't seem to be a policy in place that says if it becomes evident that you are fully AI, we will do this or that, or we'll, you know, donate half your sales to charity or whatever. There doesn't seem to be any risk involved in doing this for the game's developers to speak of outside of public reputation.
Public reputation does play a big role in this. Do you think that there will be developers coming out of the proliferation of generative AI through game development saying, we are proudly made by people, we do not use generative AI in our creative decisions and processes, we are coding art, please support us?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that already with quite a few studios when they promote their works. They're like, proudly not made with AI or completely human-made. So it is now a major selling point. And we've seen it with, despite how much I do love the game, Clair Obscur Expedition 33, they actually had some AI-generated concept art in the game on release that they didn't detect in quality assurance, which is really unfortunate. But the Indie Game Award, which they won Game of the Year for, actually got stripped because of that. So it's like public reputation is such a major sticking point here, and I think for developers seeing these consequences for these major games that no one's really safe kind of thing.
That being said, and I actually agree with you, but that being said, the jury is still out in a way, because while there are surveys out there that suggest like 80% of gamers dislike AI in games, but the people who are talking out about this tend to be the ones who are genuinely opposed to it. And it's kind of squeaky wheel territory where the ones who don't care, the ones who just want to, you know, see head go boom or see score go up or whatever it is you want out of your game, those people are, they're not even commenting on AI. They may well not care. And it comes down to that question of, you know, is this game a product? Is it a commercial product? Is it a piece of art? I would argue it should be both.
Correct.
But if you are just viewing it commercially, it may not impact their sales massively. We've still got to kind of wait and see, because we're still fairly new into this field of, even of when developers are being honest and saying, yes, we're using AI. I would certainly personally support human-produced games, but I have this sneaking suspicion that there's a reasonable number of gamers out there who are just going to go, oh, as long as I enjoy the game, I don't care.
So the squeaky wheels, the ones that are being loud out there, what is their main point of concern here? Is it about that creative integrity? Are they concerned about job losses? Is it data ethics? What is the core point of their argument here?
So I think it's a mix of two things. Partially, it's the creative soul aspect. It's the, we want human connection through this game by knowing that a human actually created it or was responsible for most of its creation or the creation of its music or art or, you know, whichever bit of the game touches your personal soul. Partially, it is a bit of a recognition, and this, I think, becomes a little bit more personal, as to, you know, voice artists being out of work, graphic artists being out of work, model artists being out of work because their stuff's just being, even if it's just placeholder, is being procedurally generated, and a kind of recognition that that's not necessarily good for games as a creative industry.
Mm. Do we know that for a fact? Do we have any evidence that games using generative AI are materially different in quality?
It's just plain as day when you see, particularly on the storefronts of like Nintendo's, PlayStation, Xbox, and you see these copy and paste games that are just slapped onto there where it's like cow farming sim with chicken and then you click on it and it's barely usable.
It's a goat.
It's a goat.
And hey, they made lots of money out of Goat Simulator.
They sure did. So they tried.
For those who haven't played it, Goat Simulator is a game where you play as a goat. End of story.
Yeah. this kind of era of just generate, pump stuff out. Mm. Kind of reminds me of in the 80s before the video game crash where everything was like the same game, copy and paste over and over.
So everything like, was a Space Invaders clone.
Or a Pong clone.
Or a Pac-Man clone. Yes, exactly.
Basically, consumers or players just lost confidence in what was being produced and why should they trust these developers or why should they trust these storefronts anymore. So
it's even worse in mobile gaming.
Yes.
You look at the mobile gaming storefronts and there's so many badly programmed, largely Grand Theft Auto clones.
Yes.
Which are these empty worlds where they've just dumped some stuff. They've dumped some procedurally generated AI. Nothing really works, but they don't care, even if the game is free, because you've had to watch an ad before you started playing.
Correct.
And they've made the money.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Alex Kidman, freelance technology journalist at Alex Reviews Tech, and also Chloe Appleby, games curator at the Powerhouse Museum. And look, there's global supply chain headaches, currency swings, ever more ambitious hardware. The cost of entry to playing video games just seems to be going up and up. So when we're talking about consoles getting more and more expensive, how much more expensive do we actually mean? Yeah, I think they've always been seen as a bit of a big purchase. They're the Christmas gift. They're the birthday gift. They're not something you pick up with the groceries. But how much do they cost today compared to the dark ages when I was a kid? So for reference, I got a NES back in 1986. Alex, where are we at? How much does it cost to buy a console?
So I've got good news and bad news right now. Although looking back on this in 6 months could be a very, very different picture, which I suspect we'll get to. If you'd bought a NES in Australia in the mid to late 80s, it would have cost you at retail $295. I was able to find with a little bit of digging an ad for one in, I think, 1987. $295. And adjusting for inflation, that machine was worth just over $900.
Wow, my parents shelled out.
They did.
Thanks,
Mum
and Dad.
And you know, if you look at like a Switch 2 is around $700, a PlayStation 5 is around $800. Mm-hmm. So that is actually a little bit cheaper. Where this gets really interesting, of course, is if you look at console games, because back in the day, I mean, when the Super Nintendo, undeniably the greatest console system of all time, was current in Australia, you'd pay somewhere between $80 to $120 for one game. Now, that's sort of the pricing we pay now, and people might think, well, prices haven't changed, except bear in mind, this was like 1992, and $80 in 1992 money is about $250 now, and nobody is paying $250 for one game outside of those ridiculous collector's editions which come with, you know, an inflatable swimming pool and a plane ticket.
How dare you call my most treasured possessions ridiculous, Alex?
They're wonderfully ridiculous, but they are ridiculous. I mean, I think people who buy collector's editions know that they're wonderfully ridiculous.
Okay, so the latest price hikes we've seen, what's causing them? How much of this is genuinely outside of the manufacturer's control?
It's so frustrating because it's because of the RAM shortage caused by these massive data centers for AI causing mass memory storage problems and issues. Mm. So that's why the cost of everything is going up. The ROG's now been increased. It's a handheld gaming system, which has now been increased to $1,800 because of the RAM being so scarce. Sony is considering pushing back their next gen of PlayStations and consoles to 2028, 2029 because of this issue. It's affecting quite a lot of industries, but impacting games, I think, quite visibly.
And I think the other big thing here is, especially for the current generation of consoles, they're built around what are modified PC parts a bit more so than previously used to be the case. So they're so much more subject to that need for PC parts. I mean, RAM for sure, but also GPUs and storage come into play. And all of those are being funneled into AI data centers because that's where the big money is. Mm-hmm. And they're putting, you know, huge orders in. So, yeah, every single console manufacturer is looking at it and going, well, can we continue at this price? Are we going to put the price up? And we saw that, I think it was last year, although this was more tariff related, with a rise in the price of the PlayStation 5. And that was global to take into account essentially what was going to happen in the US market.
When we look back at consoles and the way that they used to be priced and released, they were always sold at a loss, generally speaking, for the console producers, because they made their money back on those games. Those games that you're talking about that cost, you know, $250 in today's money, that was the real moneymaker. With subscription models and the like coming in, has that business model changed? Are they now trying to sell consoles at a profit?
Well, yes, the business model has changed. It did depend on the manufacturer. Nintendo, rather infamously, always tended to sell things very close to the line, maybe a theoretical profit, although once you build R&D and marketing in there, I don't think they were really making a lot of money on an individual console sale. But as that model has shifted from ownership to rental, which is what a subscription is, especially for something like the Xbox, I mean, nobody buys Xbox games anymore. If you've got an Xbox, you get Game Pass. If you don't have Game Pass on an Xbox, you should probably sell that Xbox because you're probably not using it for much.
So Game Pass is a subscription service.
Yes, it's Microsoft's gaming subscription service, which is built around both download and streaming of games. Other platforms are, of course, available on different consoles and for different services.
Easy way to think of it is Netflix for games.
Yes.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Chloe Appleby, games curator at the Powerhouse Museum, and Alex Kidman, freelance technology journalist at Alex Reviews Tech. And virtual reality, it was supposed to transform how we work and socialise and collaborate, but instead, most of us, even if we choose to, will only strap on a headset to play games and then pop it back up on the shelf. So why did this grand vision of virtual offices and meetings fail to take off in the way that tech companies keep predicting? This is a cyclical thing. Alex, you'd know this.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of reasons. And one of the primary ones is because they were applying an existing office metaphor, the idea that you know, sit in an open plan office, maybe with a laptop or whatever in front of you, to a virtual space without thinking about how those tools were actually meant to work or whether it was better. And then it hit some really significant, and still continues to hit, some significant barriers in terms of the available technology and the cost of that technology.
Yeah, so was the barrier technical limitations? I'm thinking, you know, things like comfort and resolution, or just straight up that people don't want to wear a headset for 8 hours a day, which I think is perfectly reasonable, Chloe.
I think it's very reasonable. A VR headset is quite uncomfortable, particularly if you have motion sickness. But I think a VR headset working for that time frame as well, because the battery life on these things don't last actually 8 hours at all. So you could be halfway through a project and then you have to recharge, and it becomes a whole issue for workplace sustainability. It just doesn't work.
I've always thought of augmented reality a bit more of a natural fit for work and daily life. You know, it's a much slimmer profile. You can just pop them on slightly bigger than regular glasses. It seems a bit more reasonable. Alex, how do you feel about augmented reality versus VR for work applications?
So I think AI has some huge advantages in this space. Although, again, we've been kind of on this treadmill for a long while now. Things like Microsoft HoloLens and so on have been around for a long time. But, you know, we're not all sitting in this studio wearing them. And I think a big part of that is the other aspect that VR, of course, removes if you're sitting in an office with other people, is you can see people's faces, you can react and interact with their body language, where if I had a huge VR headset on right now, the best you might see out of the current cutting edge are some digital versions of my eyes, which is not the same thing.
No, it's a bit creepy, Apple. Stop it. So are there industries where VR outside of gaming is genuinely thriving, even if it's not obvious to the regular people walking around? I think I've seen some applications in the training space that seem quite successful.
Yeah, training, particularly for engineering, anything for manufacturing where it has a hazardous environment, it really eliminates all those safety risks where they're able to actually do the practice without causing bodily harm, which is fantastic. I've also seen great examples of VR being used in the medical field. So there's a product called SmileyScope where they put it on for children, and instead of for needles where they're feeling a bit anxious and a bit afraid, they get to put that on and walk through this game. And then before the needle hits, a kind of a distraction, and then they're fine. Same thing for dementia patients too. Mm. There's therapy there to, again, reduce anxiety, fears, and also helps to induce memory. So I think there's some great uses for VR.
There's a great Australian-produced dementia app, which looks at the other side of dementia as well. Ooh. This is not therapy. It's actually training. It's giving people an experience of what a person living with dementia goes through raise empathy in them, to make them. It would be one thing to say, right, you know, someone with dementia may experience some level of hallucination. It's another thing to go through a scenario where you do that, in terms of how you're then going to relate to a patient. And I love that. And medical, there's some studies that suggest that, you know, people who do really intensive heart surgery and stuff, and obviously it's a lot safer to accidentally operation-style stab a virtual patient than a real one, but even the study side of it is said to be more effective, because as human beings, we're visual animals, so showing those kind of visual things as opposed to saying, read the textbook, and interacting with it as opposed to saying, watch this YouTube video, is a lot better, or can be a lot better. But it's in those very specific short-term use cases where, as you're saying, you don't need 8 hours, you maybe need half an hour or an hour's worth of training. You stop. In my case, I wouldn't even last half an hour, because I'm one of those people who gets horribly unwell with every VR headset known to man.
We still haven't solved the issue of seasickness.
Not entirely, not yet.
No. Soon, I think.
I feel like I'm never. Every single generation, they said, oh, put this on. And I've said, look, these tend to make me feel really bad. Oh, no, these are much higher refresh rate, much better screens. You'll be fine. I can last I've been doing this long enough that I can remember the very first, you know, Oculus generation stuff, which by modern standards is incredibly primitive. Those things I could last a couple of seconds. Now maybe 30 seconds to a minute. But even then, I've got to go and sit down and wait till the room stops spinning or, you know, till I've lost the last of my lunch, as it were. So I'm not keen on a workforce where I'd have to use VR.
Look, we are almost out of time, but I would love to hear from you some technology that has brought you some joy this week.
So I'm going to bang a familiar drop for anyone who knows me and say retro gaming in general, because I've tended to keep my console stuff. And I quite happily will go back and pick up an 8-bit or a 16-bit game and play that and just have simple fun. And I encourage people to give older games a try, both to look at where gaming came from, but because there are some games out there which are absolutely unrecognized gems, not just your kind of Pac-Man, Space Invaders, Street Fighter II kind of stuff, But the stuff that was around the periphery there, there are some amazing games for every platform, and not everything has to cost a fortune. And, of course, you buy the cartridge, you own the thing, and you just, you know, you keep it in reasonable working order. I have 30, 40-year-old consoles that work as well today as when they were bought. It's wonderful, and it's made me very, very happy this week, as it does, to be fair, most weeks.
Co-op party at your house, Alex.
Absolutely.
Chloe, has there been any tech that's brought you joy this week?
There's one bit of tech that has brought me much joy since January. It's a recent purchase of mine. I am late to the party. It's my iPad.
Oh, nice.
I love learning. And one of the things that I found really difficult was taking notes and keeping them in a nice spot where I can actually look them up instead of writing them down on a notebook. And I'm like, uh-oh.
Which notebook was that in?
I don't know. I've lost this one bit. So actually, my iPad's been very helpful to keep me organized. The joke at work is, oh, Chloe's gaming iPad's out. And I'm like, yep, it's out. I'm taking notes now. It's, but I feel weird if I go without taking notes on my iPad every day. So it's my favorite tech.
Chloe Appleby, thank you so much for joining us on Download This Show. Where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, so you can find me online on Instagram, Chloe Appleby, as well as TikTok, Blue Sky. I'm also at the Powerhouse Museum, so you can follow our Powerhouse socials on Instagram as well as on our website. And we'll be making an announcement for our upcoming Games Festival Alt in the next coming week, so keep a lookout for that.
Fantastic, looking forward to it. Alex Kidman, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Where can people find you and your work?
So I've been around for a long while, so you'll find little bits of me everywhere these days. But predominantly you can find me on YouTube, you can find me on most social networks, and you can find my writing work at alexreviewstech.com.
And now some more tech news from the week that was. In case you missed it, executives from Meta and TikTok have been grilled by the Australian Senate Select Committee on Misinformation over how their platforms handle climate change disinformation. Senators across the political spectrum pressed them on transparency, moderation processes, and whether harmful content is being sufficiently tackled. The two-day hearing also heard evidence from science communicator Dr. Carl and the Human Rights Commissioner on broader misinformation risks. Complaints to the telecommunications industry ombudsman rose 3.6% to more than 14,000 in the December quarter, following outages affecting 000 and mobile services. The ombudsman cited fallout from the Optus network disruption and handset-related emergency call issues. More than 6,000 of the complaints were linked to mobile services. And users are reacting strongly as OpenAI shuts down ChatGPT 4.0, including the partner and highly personalised features. Many have taken to social media to describe feeling grief and loss, saying their in-app AI companions were an important part of daily life. Mental health experts warn the shutdown highlights how some people can form deep emotional bonds with AI, and the backlash underscores the challenge of balancing engagement with safety. And that is all for this week. Be sure to subscribe to Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating wherever you can. And as always, send us a voice note or an email to downloadthisshow@abc.net.au. We'd love to hear your feedback. And also, if there are any technology mysteries or issues you would like us to cover. My name is Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.